Invocation of Kanzeyan. We call upon Kanzeyan to inspire our sutra and our lives. We call upon ourselves to inspire Kanzeyan. We call upon ourselves as Kanzeyan, enlightening, being enlightened, calling and responding, the birds and stars as Kanzeyan save us, as themselves save us. Each thought, ever so brief, is Kanzeyan herself, turning the Dharma wheel. Acceptance is Kanzeyan. Regarding the sounds of the world is Kanzeyan. Kanzeyan is realized in regarding the distress and pain everywhere, and is realized by the sound of geckos and children. The compassionate action of Kanzeyan arises from the place of grateful receiving. I venerate the great power for the way, which is generated by the profound act of opening myself. Kanzeyan, thus, we bow to Buddha. Well, sun is out, a bright, wonderful morning, brilliant snow after the snowfall. And we're deep into the coming and going Ango, Kyoche, lots of coming and going, lots of appearances and disappearances, lots of responses and reactions and appreciations and responses to all of the coming and to the going. I'm always appreciative of people as the zendo fills in the evening and the new reinforcements come, but also as they flow back out, as the tide receives and they flow back out and are off to the many places in their lives. I'm appreciative of this small group of wayfarers, of fellow pilgrims and practitioners. I spend a lot of time traveling, sitting with old friends. It's my Dharma job. I live, as many of you know, in a Zen center, a Zen community in Kentucky, in the mountains, in a vast tract of 800 acres. And almost usually every month or sometimes twice a month, I'm off to visit old friends in Seattle or in Boston, Worcester, Florida, Alabama, around this everywhere place. Sitting with old friends. And what we do when we get together is since there is no temple, we have no temple specifically for the single flower sangha, we just go to people's homes and we clear out the living room and invite people to come. And we do this for 3 days, 5 days, sometimes 7 days. So we gather with old friends. Many of these people I've known. I feel quite blessed to have this gig, because most of the people who come are people that I've known 10, 20, 30 years. So we have a body of old friends and through sitters, and people come and go just like here. But usually the groups are fairly small. A big group would be 20. Sometimes there's 6, 7, 10, 15 of us. Actually, I don't think the size matters, whether there's 40 people or 3 people, as long as we show up and commit to the work. But personally, I feel most comfortable with small groups, so there's a kind of relief I feel at least. But then again, when I look at the small group, I can start counting people and saying, gee, there aren't many people here. I wonder if that's a reflection on what we're... You know, you go all over the place with all of these things, but... that being said, I do feel more comfortable in small, intimate groups and feel privileged to be here with good friends along the way. This Raksu, maybe for some of you it's quite familiar. David used to wear it. I gave it to him at the transmission ceremony we had here some years ago. And it was given to me by Tangan Harada Roshi, quite a famous Zen master, revered Zen master in Japan, when I was at the Cambridge Buddhist Association. And I treasure it as one of those, we all have things that we treasure, material objects that we treasure and take great pride in. And, and hold on to. I thought when David got transmission, I should give him something that pinched me a little bit, or actually more than pinched me. I thought, oh God, I can't. Oh, I will though. So I gave it to him and was happy to. I wanted to give him something that I loved and treasured and cherished profoundly, as a gift for his launching him into this his teaching career as a Zen teacher. So he took the gift. Speaking of giving, receiving, and giving, giver and recipient, gift and giver being one thing, I remember at the ceremony, speaking of the Ta of Shikantaza, giving him his Raksu, I thought, there's only one thing I have to remember not to do during the ceremony. These large groups, there must have been 100 or so people, I find a little sometimes overwhelming. Slightly intimidating, so many energies and people. It's like having 100 radios playing in the room, in the same room, and you have to find your way in it. But I thought to myself, you'll be fine as long as you don't hit heads when you bow to each other. That was the one thing I thought, I'm sure not to do. So with perfect target fixation accuracy, when we bowed to each other, we smacked heads resoundly and met Shikantaza, to touch and be touched by. And there we were. He was wearing my Raksu, and we touched, and each one of us touched and was touched by something. And in that touching, in that clonking of heads, the one thing that I most didn't want to do, there are some other things that I did. But it was high on the list, high on the embarrassment body cringe Richter scale. But but in that touching, in that clanking of heads, there is there's a moment of recognition that is not recognized, because it's so immediate and so bright and shoots through you, almost like lightning. It shoots through you. And then afterwards, there might be a moment of, actually, I think for both of us, because there's so much love and great respect, there is the humor of it all and the foolishness of it all and the whole mix of feelings that emerges, and the recognition that you just did what you swore you wouldn't do, like be like your mother or father or all the other things we swear we shouldn't do, but there you are. But there is that moment of encounter, ta, and that ta, or that encounter, where the gift and the giver and the receiver are one thing, one body, one brightness, one clarity, is wonderful and very, very, very clear. So now, after some years, David gave me my Raksu back, which was, I'm hoping it pinched him a little bit to give it back to him. And but also, he has something that I really want. I figure maybe there's some way I can wheedle it out of him publicly. And that's the incense burner on the altar. The really nice one to the right of the Buddha. Yeah.
Dream on.
I thought, I gave that to him years ago when we first, I don't know, it was a pretty long time ago, and it was another one of those objects that I thought, man, he's going to really owe me if I give this to him. And anyway, there it sits on the altar. So whenever I walk by it, I say, damn, that's a fine incense burner. And maybe if I just mention it in the Dharma talk, he might give it back to me. So here we are invoking Kanzeon. Kanzeon. We've been talking about Koan and Shikantaza, and this capacity we have to be a Kan, one who knows, but one who knows in a very direct and heartfelt way. Kan means literally perception, but it doesn't really quite capture the depth and meaning of our experience when we know something. In a very immediate and intimate way, know it so that there is no space between us. Know it and appreciate it in that kind of way, where there's no space between us. a kind of knowing that doesn't require thought or understanding. And certainly when we emerge from that kind of knowing, whether it be appreciating a flower, a friend, whatever it is, we perceive the world in a new and fresh way, and we're in some way restored. Our vision is refreshed for at least a little while. The scales are taken off our eyes, and we unwrap the present of this present moment, and we all smile and feel some sense of gratitude. Maybe it's a very deep sense of gratitude where tears darken our roxu, or maybe it's just a gentle nod of understanding and appreciation. But that sense of gratitude and connection and appreciation is unmistakable. I remember at the Providence Zen Center, I had in the early days a big opening with my teacher, Sansanin, after struggling mightily with the koan for many years, working with it and struggling with it and going through all of the changes we do when we're looking into something that is really important to us. It finally did open in Sansan, or an interview during a retreat downstairs in the Zendo, filled with people, you know, 20 or 30 people just like us, sitting away, looking into the great matter, being one with breath, one with the koan, one with whatever, or one with the posture of Zazen or Shikan or quiet illumination. And we looked at each other. We didn't really look at each other, but we both burst out laughing and laughed and laughed and laughed until the building shook with laughter. Tears pouring down both of our faces as we laughed with each other. And I remember Sansanin asking me, when it calmed down enough to recognize that there were two people in the room, he said, and how is it for you now? Where are you now? We often ask each other that question, and we pose that question in meetings. It's quite an important question, because of course wherever you are is the koan itself, is the truth happening place, the place where truth is happening. And of course it's always this place. So when we look into or are one with or show up as we are and allow that self that shows up to be thoroughly perforated or dissolved in the presence, or allow that self to melt down a little bit, or allow ourselves to soften enough to see that the content of that self, or we might say the substance, which of course is not something we can recognize, is nothing but goodness and clarity, then we are restored and we feel a sense of gratitude. So he asked me, well, where are you now? And I said, I feel such immense gratitude. And I began crying, sobbing and crying. And I remember him saying, in his very grandfatherly kind way, he said, gratitude is most important, Georgie, is to be grateful. So certainly when we touch and are touched by the aliveness of this moment, if the touching is genuine, I think, spontaneously, gratitude is born. A great warmth and appreciation and profound gratitude. And it's beyond words or understanding, but it is so palpably true that it's just that way, isn't it? Kanzeon is the one who can, the capacity that we have in so many degrees, varying degrees, to appreciate what's going on, not as an object, but as the activity of life itself. And of course, there is no more precious thing than your own life. And of course, it's not your life, but this life, this one endless dimension, universal, bright, intelligent, whatever you want to call it. And I think all of us during Sesshin begin to get this in a very deep, quiet way. I often ask people to just stop breathing for 30 seconds and reflect on what it is that is most important. And when you then suck in the air, or you breathe in there, it's bright and refreshing and wonderful and clear, and nothing possibly could be more important or more valuable than that, the goodness of that breath. And we are awakened and inspired. My brother used to, we used to go swimming. We had a cottage in the dunes. I grew up in the south side of Chicago. And every summer we would escape from the cities. The south side of Chicago was a rugged place to live. The university district, University of Chicago, my dad taught in the law school, was a wonderful place, but the area surrounding was a really, really tough place. So we escaped to Dunes State Park and had a little cottage and would spend weeks in the summer there. Some of my great fond memories of growing up were swimming in Lake Michigan. I actually could swim before I could walk, so I feel incredibly at home in the water. Anyway, my brother and I used to spend endless hours at the beach swimming, and one of his great delights, as older brothers have, you know, I think certain delights are commendable that are questionable for the recipient, was to hold my head underwater. So we would go swimming and laugh and play as kids do and splash each other, and the water would dance and sparkle in the sunlight, and we'd fool and play and have a grand time. And then we would roughhouse in the water. My brother was 3 years older, so I didn't stand a chance with him. Sometimes, you know, we'd start fighting, and then it would turn from laughing to crying. You know how it does. Anyway, he would then dunk me and hold my head underwater. You know, and at first it's no problem, I'm just underwater. And then the sense of urgency and desperation grows and grows and grows. And it's not a laughing matter anymore. And then he would wait for a while to really torture me, and then take his hand off my head, and I would burst into the sunlight and into breathing. Nothing more wonderful, I think. What an opening that was for me as a young boy to really get that. Not the peace of being upset with my brother. I love my brother dearly and love to fool with him and love to be terrorized by him, because I know how much he loved me, so I had great trust. But it would burst to the surface and breathe and see the brightness and the sparkles of the water and the people on the beach. And so there it was. So emerging from, as Soen Nakagawa said, we emerge from the Dead Sea, my body glittering spring water. So we all, too, in our practice of looking into the great matter, or shining the light within, or retracing the radiance, as Chinul in the Korean tradition said, we go into deep places at times where we forget ourselves. We breathe and we forget ourselves in the breathing at times. Or maybe it might not be on the cushion. Maybe we forget ourselves in the activity of chopping vegetables. Or maybe on the cushion we forget ourselves in the activity of chanting. But certainly in sitting there are times where we enter into a world which is before thinking. It is a vast, timeless, limitless world of pure possibility. And we all, that is our home of homes. That is the heartland of Kanzeon. And of course the heartland of Kanzeon is not recognized by the eyes that perceive from the objectified self, that look out on the world as an object. But certainly when we enter into that garba, it's called in Buddhism Tathagata Garba, the womb of the Buddha, we enter into some timeless a place where there is no inside or outside. And certainly when we emerge from that place, we see the world with fresh, more innocent eyes. So that moment of perception when we emerge from a place of not knowing, or a place of forgetfulness in the deep sense of not absent-mindedness, but true freedom from the tyranny of the thinking mind. We all do that. And we emerge from that space. We make contact in that emergence, and that is Khan. that's where Kanzayan, this capacity we have as bodhisattvas to appreciate and to receive and know and be known by our experience in the world, and we appreciate it. We emerge in that place, and it's quite a thing, isn't it? David and I go for a walk every day at, in the afternoon before sitting to refresh ourselves, and we walk out of the safety and the security of this zendo, of this incubus that we sit in, and we walk out into the bright world, fresh, bright world, quite a wonderful thing, emerging from, and then touching and being touched by something. We go for a walk. Two old friends go walking together. So Khan of the Kanzayan, a Khan of Shikantaza, Khan of slightly different character but very similar, of Kensho, you know, intimidates and freaks us all out, I think, a lot, those words. And also the word samadhi is a word that, well, I don't know anything about samadhi, or there are words that for some people are arouse the a certain sense of inadequacy or fearfulness, but leaving that aside, to perceive, show means nature, the Chinese character for show means nature, and ken means to perceive the nature. But this kind of perception, this kind of grateful, innocent, yawning clam perception, it doesn't see things as an object. So we hear the word kensho and we think, whoa, I will see it as an object. But the word kensho in the Zen tradition, the implication of ken and kan, is not to perceive something as an object at all. So you don't see something called your nature that's bright and clear and wonderful, or that's transparent or luminous or knowable in any way. From that mind that wishes to know it, doesn't have a handshaking acquaintance and doesn't see it when it slaps it in the face most of the time, and yet it doesn't stop me or you from wanting to see it from that perspective, or fixate it or hold it, bottle it or take it home with us. But the sense of the word ken in kensho is that just seeing is the nature. So kensho is not something that we see with the mind that would look upon the world and try to find what its image or idea or thought about the world is. Of course, that image or that idea that we endlessly pursue doesn't exist. It's a fabrication of our mind. We all, I suppose, have some spiritual materialism, as Trungpa used to say, that we chase after. But the word kensho means that just seeing is the nature. That immediate and that close, or just hearing is the nature, or just smelling is the nature, or just walking is the nature, let's see, or just eating is the nature, nothing but this. Sansang used to tease us in the early days of the Providence Sense, and he said, so many kinds of kensho, what kind of kensho do you want? Then he'd say, eating kensho, walking kensho, shitting kensho, smiling kensho, laughing kensho, crying kensho, sad, happy kensho. What kind of kensho? The word ken means to perceive or to inhabit or participate in. So just seeing, just hearing is the nature, Kanzayon. Interesting also, there's a practice in Zen that's quite revered in my training that I've been, I mean, always were endless students, no end to it. I consider myself a player coach, but there's a word, kana, that we use also. We read these sutras. When I read these, when I read a text and have to say something about it, I don't have a plan. Actually, I was trained to not have a plan, to study and sit hard and dialogue and practice as we do, but then to get up on top of the pole and jump, and trust that if you jump, bright things will appear, and the mind that doesn't know can pick that book off the shelf of the Alaya consciousness, or go with that, whatever it is that's there, and there will be a deep organizing principle that will organize you and care for you and take care of it if you trust just what's seemed to be true and alive. It's quite disorienting in a way, because it's like you don't know, you have to abandon the mind of planning and rehearsal and a plan, but it's quite wonderful if you can, when you get into it, it's sort of a jazz rendition, and you just go with whatever is bright and whatever is alive. And then, of course, when I start thinking, then I lose my way and forget where I was, and can get embarrassed. So certain momentum, I suppose, is helpful in the practice. So where was I, David? I was just somewhere, and I just lost myself. What was I talking about? Actually, I'm asking you quite seriously if you remember. Maybe he doesn't remember. He might have been asleep, so I woke him. But so I read these words, and one or two of them will jump out. So what jumped out for me is, thus we bow to Buddha. And this practice of Kana Zen in some schools of koan study is quite revered. So Kan means to perceive, and Na means the topic. So Kana means to perceive the topic. And of course, Kan is this kind of knowing or closeness or participation in what's going on, happy, sad, joyful, angry, that we are capable of. And when we perceive the topic or know the topic or inhabit the topic in that way, we are inspired and our heart is quickened and something moves. Even if it's a very minor kind of participation, there's always some kind of movement and freshening and refreshment that takes place. It can be a big refreshing, or it can be a slight little open the window and a crack of fresh air blows through, but certainly there is a refreshment, a refreshing that takes place when we perceive the topic in that way. And we are, if we're working hard, often quite surprised that we might find ourselves in a place that is so old and familiar that we think we know it, and we enact it so many times as we circumambulate around the stupa of ourselves again and again and again, we assume that we know that place. I've been there so many times, there's nothing to be known there. I'll just skip over it. And I think that we all skip over it, thinking that we know it, but and that skip, or the place where the record is broken and we skip, is a blank spot, and we are oftentimes spit out of what's going on, and we wake up in some other place and we don't know quite how we got there, but we are spit out. So as we approach and practice Kan, or inhabiting or attending to, not as a technique but as a way of appreciating this brief fleeting life, there is a certain gravitational force that spits you out of this. Oftentimes you're touch and go, you're spit out. But if you really arouse the way-seeking mind, not as a mechanical determination, but as a way of really caring and drawing upon all of your love and resources to attend, not in a mechanical way, but because you care and because you love. And as you get to that place that is so familiar that you start to go into the blackout, we enter into the blackout. When you enter into the blackout before this place of entering into a non-dual world or the heartland, you become disoriented. And in that disorientation, or in that vertigo that happens when you get really close to the quick of the matter, especially around places that are familiar or inspire the emotional imperative or the impulse of necessity to do something or get out of here, you have to really bear the off sensation and the vertigo that happens for all of us. And if you bear it and you really summon yourself up and allow yourself to be in the dark, so to speak, like groping for a light switch and you don't know where it is, and there's that sense of impatience and panic where you want to find it quickly so you don't have to bear that offness. But if you summon yourself up and enter into this space, it's like squeezing through a hole that is exactly a hole in the wall, so to speak, that is exactly your size, shape, and dimension. And you can't get through with anything extra. You have to totally inhabit the place with your whole self, with all of your attention, with your love. Like trying to imagine that there was a wall between inside and so-called inside and outside, and the wall were the exact shape and size of your outline. And you had to squeeze through that space. And if there was anything sticking to you extra about you, then your sincerity and genuineness, you wouldn't get through, and you'd be caught, and you'd struggle, and you wouldn't know how to do it. In Zen, we say it's like a rat or a mouse that goes down a bull's horn, goes down, 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 and there's plenty of room to move until you get right down into the quick of the matter, and then it gets really close. And if you bear the vertigo and really apply yourself, not in a muscular way, but in the way of fully engaging, we say fully engaging Bendo a body and mind, then you squeeze through, and you squeeze into a dimensionless place that has no inside or outside. And you inhabit what you thought was impossible, and you see it. You see it and you experience your experience there from an inside that has no outside, and that which was your problem is your resource. It's quite a miraculous thing. That is the heart of a Kanzeon. You are touched, you touch, and you are touched by something, and the touching is immediate and true and clear. So here we are, wonderful, all good Dharma friends, journeying on through peaks and valleys, and going through our changes, our many changes. And when I'm lost in the wilderness, sometimes David's quite awake and bright, or when I'm feeling bad, Melissa is smiling and happy, and I assure that my badness means something, and she looks and smiles at me, and I see that actually that's not what my feeling means at all. So here we are, and we all inspire each other and are inspired by each other, and we all carry on. Thank you.
So I invite you to sit comfortably, and we'll have our opportunity for speaking and listening, comments, concerns, complaints. George, I was caught a little bit when you were talking. We just passed over this fear of samadhi, mm-hmm. and I notice sometimes when I listen to you or some other people talk, I imagine that they're talking about something else other than me.
Right.
Like I think, oh, he's got something, and whatever he has, I'm sure I don't have it, but I really want it.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about that place?
Yeah, so many kinds of samadhi, aren't there? I mean, cutting carrot samadhi. You, Artenzo prepares dinner and cuts carrots and cuts vegetables. And when if you watch him, he's pretty great Tenzo, and he's in there and he's hard at it. And he to some degree, forgets himself in the cutting of the vegetables. So that would be cutting samadhi. In other words, he's just absorbed in the activity. Now, when you come out of absorption in the activity, right, you reflect upon it and you say, I'm a really shit, he Tenzo, I hope that the dinner was good enough. Or you may say, I'm a really great Tenzo, and I hope people really appreciate the hard work, and I can come over here and take care of you knuckleheads. You know, but certainly the mind does that. So when I see you, when you're cutting, I feel grateful and you're absorbed in your cutting. And I say, wow, what, this is really wonderful. The God's really taking care of us. And you have an impact on me, which is actually quite wonderful. And I'm really grateful for what you're doing. Now, when you come out of cutting vegetables, you have probably all kinds of thoughts about your cutting and the quality of it. But in the moment of forgetfulness where there is someone cutting, it's quite wonderful. And you don't know the impact you have because you've forgotten yourself, thank goodness, in the activity. If you didn't, you'd screw up the cutting, cut your finger or something. So in that kind of absorption, you have forgotten yourself in the activity and are freed from the tyranny of how am I, how was I, how will I be, to some degree or to some depth. And I think all of us, that is the activity of Dharma, that there is some force or some aliveness that is actually incredibly wise and capable, loving and knowing from all of those kinds of degrees that lives through us, and we forget ourselves and are lived through it and are living it. What an incredible thing. And then we emerge and say, well, not me. I don't know anything about that. And in a way, it's true. That's the beautiful thing about Zen, because there is no place that it doesn't inhabit. You know, I come out of my sitting, right, of putting myself in this sitting, and I have no clue about whether I had any impact or not on anybody. I'm just sitting, you know, just when I'm really absorbed in it. And I come out and I think, gee, I have all kinds of thoughts about the depth and quality of my practice, usually not such good ones, because that's my nature, that, you know, never enough, you know, more is necessary and all of that. But in the moment when I'm sitting, if you come by, if the Tenzo comes by and sees me deep at it, after all these years, he says, wow, this dude is, he's really having at it.
Maybe. I'm cooking for these people.
Anyway,
for him.
But anyway, so that's and that on many dimensions is whether it's in sitting or caring for children, or so we all intimately don't know a great deal about it, but we hear the word and then we think. But the mind that thinks that thought wouldn't recognize it if it slapped it in the face.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think one of the things for me, and you and I were talking about this, is the tendency that all of us have to take these words and make concepts out of them. We could do that with samadhi, kensho, and even kanzan.
Right.
You know, and we do make these concepts. And then it looks like, because it's a concept or an object, so George sits in samadhi and Jason cuts carrots in samadhi, and we think, I want that. I want to be that person. Right. So how do I get it? You know, how do I obtain samadhi or obtain kensho, this dropping away of everything? How do I, is there some person named Kanzan who is going to respond to my heart's despair? Mm. This is where the mind goes. And I think it's very important to know that we're not making samadhi happen. We're incapable of making samadhi happen or making kensho happen. We are surrendering ourselves through our zazen, through our sitting upright and present, to something much bigger than us. And this is this point. I want to underline what George is saying is so important. The me that devotes myself and forms the intention to sit is not the me that experiences anything called samadhi or kensho. As you said, if we know we're experiencing it, we're not experiencing it. We're experiencing the idea or the concept of it.
Right.
So there's this quality, and I wonder how many of us have had this experience on retreat or even in daily practice, where you know, we set a timer if we're all by ourselves, or the bell rings, mm-hmm. and then the bell rings again, and we think there's something wrong with the timer, and 25 minutes have gone by, 40 right, minutes have gone by. In that, and then we can say, "Wow, I think I was probably in samadhi," and then you're lost again. Or maybe I had a kensho, and I better go see a Zen teacher quick. The danger of affirming it to ourselves or having it affirmed is that it becomes a thing that we want to get back. And how did I do it? Oh, I know what I did. I wore the dark turtleneck. And so that appeared to facilitate this. So now I'm going to do that every time. And that, maybe that'll do it. No, that didn't work. Oh, maybe it was my socks. Or maybe it was where I was. I shouldn't sit over there in the Zendo. I should, because that's where... So you see how the mind makes strategies, right? And this is really about... Really, you know, we emphasize this in Boundless Way so much. To sit still and be upright and present as much as we're capable of. Even that can become a thing. And then see what happens. Just see what happens. This kind of heart of expectancy, heart of entrusting. Expectancy without any gaining idea. Just, what is it? What is it? It's the Wado all over again. What is this? What is this? The great doubt. You know, what is it? That animates our stillness and uprightness. So I guess that would be how I might describe the preliminary spirit. Are so simple. But yeah, if we throw in, I want to be like George, I want to be like Jason, we're lost. We're absolutely, even if George throws in, I want to be like George.
Yeah,
right. He's gonna get lost.
I put on an old record of myself.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. So it's so delicate, so subtle.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
This may have. It has a flavor of what you just said, and let me see if I can verbalize this. So I really resonated with what you're talking about what seems to be a problem becomes a solution and getting through that place just for you.
Mm-hmm.
And so I left September 8th to do a transition and follow what I love.
Mm-hmm.
And in short order, I had one physical issue after another and then got totally taken down, which I would have never volunteered for. And I had all these romantic things on the mantle, like you never find new places unless you lose sight of the shore. But I was terrified when I jumped. Mm-hmm. It was a whole lot more terrifying than I ever thought it would be. Mm-hmm. And I was about to recapture pieces of the life that I had wanted to leave behind in my terror, and I was feeling buried alive. Then this back injury that just took me down, it was almost like the Lion and the Witch in the Wardrobe. I found a place that was beyond anything I'd ever dreamed of in the surrender, the beauty, and all the rest of it. And now as I begin to function again, and this sesshin has been wonderful, my question is, I have no idea what I'm going to do for a living. It's it's completely different landscape that I'm walking, even a completely different body.
Right.
How do I keep that spirit without just pulling back all the stuff that I let go of because I had no choice? I mean, I would not have voluntarily done that. I don't know if I'm making
sense. Yeah, you're making sense to me. I don't think you can. I mean, I think, you know, we sit in session and think, well, I'll keep this wonderful openness and clarity, and I go out and I sort of secretly think, well, maybe they'll give me a parade and confetti. but you won't. You can't. You start. I mean, you have a resonance inside of you, and you have a faith and a determination. But then you go out and you meet the myriad things, and you meet them as best you can, and do what you can. And I don't think there's any, you know, as David was saying, you know, specific recipe like cashews and
Manhattan.
Yeah, there's a part of me that's looking for that.
Getting
line. I'm in the line too. We're all queued up.
Where is that?
Great, thanks. Chris.
Thank you.
Yeah. See.
I, I am really interested in this samadhi thing. It's something that we don't actually talk about a whole lot. I've spent the last couple of days doing some breath practice that isn't my normal practice, and really feeling more embodied is how I am thinking, like aware of the posture and the and the sensations. And as you were talking about, the way I heard it was entering by going beyond thought, which is something that I don't normally think about. Because I normally think of actually entering through thought, you know, being present to the thoughts and emotions and everything that comes up around the and that there's an entry point there, and that's usually the way that I think of it.
Yeah,
but you're pointing out that I think this this other path of entry through you know this not separating from this skin bag. Did I hear that?
Well, so many entry points, you know. Yeah, like, just to affirm what you're saying, you know, kanza means entry through a word. So if you take up kanzaon, which I do as one of my core practices, and I repeat kanzaon again and again, I start to, the word and my experience starts to be non-separate, and I start to see kanzaon. And the word, that's called kana, perceiving the topic, and certainly the word is an entry point into some kind of experience of closeness, intimacy, oneness, whatever you want. And there's so many entry points. So there's the entry point through a word, right? Entering into life, your life, or so many entry points. Some schools of Zen, specifically some of the Rinzai schools of Zen, and these aren't sectarian divisions, they're just different ways of appreciating life, really encourage to sit very deeply in a place that is before thinking.
Right.
And then and in the doing of that, in that place of great doubt or great not knowing or great before thinking, that you, when you emerge from that space, not you, but there is something emerges you. You hear the sound of a bird call, and it's not from out there. And then you really get, oh, this bird, and you realize one true nature as the sound of the bird. It's the same place. What do you realize? You realize all along. But it's a different approach. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah. This thing about slowing down.
Yeah.
Which I don't normally see myself as really, you know, slowing down in my zazen, but the physicality and maybe using that as an anchor.
Well, I was very touched by, I don't know who, I can't remember who said what, but I'm touched by so many of the questions because I so recognize myself in them. But don't separate from your skin bag here and now.
Right.
You know, in the so-called Soto tradition, a great deal of emphasis is placed on posture or upright in the midst of your experience as the enlightened way and the enlightening way of, and the willingness to do that and to be open to experience and see there's no other place to go. But certainly when you sit with your whole body, right, when you sit with your whole body or you breathe with your whole body, you enter the body of the moment.
Right.
You enter the body of this moment. And it's not, your body is not your body, and the rest of the world is out there, but you enter the body. So don't separate from this skin bag here and now means you sit, and that kind of upright posture is and life, you're in the big body. So it's just different ways of, you know, appreciating the same thing, different emphases.
And as we're talking about it, one of the things that I just noticed in my mind is that, and it's just what we're always saying, that these are not things. Mm. Like, there's not the samadhi switch, and I hope like, a, you know, can I get across the line? I try really hard to cross the samadhi line. But it is this levels of absorption.
Yeah, it is.
And it is something all of us know. Right? All of us know.
Nothing but enacting all the time, whether we have confidence or not, that there's something deeper or greater than ourselves doing us or moving through us.
Right, and then it manifests in some way, as we were saying, that we can't know, that we don't receive it as an object.
No, I'll say.
And then if we're looking for the object to receive it or make sure we have it,
it's
already happened and maybe quite clear, as you were saying, to other people. But I'm still looking for, you know, where is it? And all the time, there's nothing but.
Nothing but.
But to have confidence in that which we cannot stand outside and see.
Well said.
You know, we cannot know our samadhi.
And I think that going deeply into your meditation practice, there is for all of us that place of vertigo or of disorientation or terror. I mean, certainly it happens in our lives in the bigness, but it's always the same fractal. So it happens on the cushion. We enter this place I enter this place often of vertigo or not knowing or groundlessness, and I begin to feel uneasy and panic. And what I do with my panic when I feel uneasy is I try to, you know, get it in my sights. And I back off from that which is very close to the heartland, and I feel uncomfortable to varying degrees, or I feel bored, or I feel terrified, or I feel frightened, or varying degrees of, and then I look for it, or remember, oh, I'm supposed to be doing this or that. But it's a really important place for all of us to enter, which is the place of not knowing, and it's scary as hell. And we don't know how it's going to turn out, and we want it to turn out right, and we're afraid that that's going to mean it's not going to turn out right, and then where the hell will we be after all these years? You know, and that will prove that you are a, then I fill in the blank, you know, quack, phony, stupid, wrong, I don't know, whatever it is, you could be on the plus side. So quite a revered place, actually, this groundless off sensation, and requires a certain great courage for all of us to enter those places. Great courage, because we don't know and we care. I mean, we wouldn't be here if we didn't really care. Mm-hmm. Right?
And I just want to add to this. This is so slippery. Because even hearing this, you know, I know that vertigo really well. I know that where everything drops away and I get scared and then grasp something.
Right.
We could experience that and go, aha, this is what George was talking about. I must be making progress. You know, it's endless. The mind is endless.
Yeah. It's relentless, isn't it?
Very creative.
Creative is an idea. Endlessly creative.
I also want to go back to this little subtle thing about thinking, which... So, you know, really, we can enter any place. And in Boundless Way Zen, we kind of make a thing out of having so many different practices that we offer people. That's why we have Doksan. So you come in and, you know, we really sense into each person and what is the practice that seems right for you now. And it could change, you know, from Doksan to Doksan, mm-hmm. but it which is great. It's very flexible and creative,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? So we do Kana Zen, we do focusing on a word, like, you know, anyone who starts with Mu knows, if you've done Mu or the Koan Mu, that's what you do at the initial stages. You just do, it's only that, and you could do Kan Zen, you could do what is it, who am I, that we do that stuff, right?
Yeah.
And then we also teach Shikantaza, and we teach breath practice, which are slightly different, although breath can be absorbed into Shikantaza, this just sitting, or just breathing, or being with whatever is arising endlessly. And not, as Sandra says, because this is where Shikantaza comes from, his school, not becoming its partner. And that's where the thinking stuff is so subtle, because we can watch the arising of thoughts and hear this teaching, I'm going to use that as an entry point and give fuel to the thoughts. I'm not suggesting you're doing that, Steve, but it's such a delicate boundary line.
Yeah.
Whereas we could spend a whole session. I remember spending a session writing a country and western song about Zen.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
And it was every time I sat down, I thought, "Oh, great! I get to add another verse." And where did that go? Nowhere. It still comes to my mind sometimes. The chorus. I can't remember.
It didn't hit the charts at all.
It didn't hit the charts. We do so Zen. Anyway, you can feed the thinking. And then there's a certain moment of waking up in the middle of that, so slippery because everybody's probably thinking, oh yeah, let me write that down. I want to do that now, right? So there isn't any doing in it. There's a sort of perceiving, a sort of receiving, right? Of thoughts are happening.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. And sometimes we get seduced. You know, the hook comes along, and I go, you know, just bite the hook on the fish, and we go off, you know, caught.
Oh, yeah.
And that's why John Tarrant sometimes calls that kind of practice catch and release. I know in terms of fishing, right?
Yeah.
Oh, get the hook out, swim yeah. over again. So there is, I've experienced this thing, because, you know, we've talked about this, I've done this practice too a lot. I try to do them all sequentially, just to keep freshened up for people and for myself, because I always learn a lot from who I am now doing this practice, you know, that I might have done 10 years ago. There is an experience I've had where when I stop feeding the thoughts, when I continually take the hook out of my mouth, it's not that they go away, because thoughts never go away, but they become so unimportant. They become part of this fabric that includes sounds and smells, and it's just not they're not vibrant.
I think that's really well said. There's something that's more interesting.
There's much more interesting.
It's really more interesting. I mean, I don't mean to necessarily to think about, but to engage in, it's so much more interesting and gratifying and full. Then it's like you'll eat dinner rather than read the menu, or you'll...
Right. Yeah. And if you just say one more thing about this, if you hear this teaching and think, so that's how you stop your thoughts, you can see almost how that's going to get us in trouble, right?
Right. Oh yeah.
Yeah. And people do this because some of the teachings you read, they talk about cutting off the mind road and stopping thinking, and think, well, I can do that. No, it's like we had this discussion the other day. You can't do anything. I can't do it. I can't do it. I can't do it. I give myself over to it in a certain way. And then, the world comes to meet us. Kanzan, not some pretty girl in a dress with flowers and an urn, but this incredible spirit of love and compassion and aliveness just shows up.
So let's keep practicing.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.